Do you love to talk about rescue dogs almost too much? Us too. This is why I created a space where we can celebrate it. This podcast is for those who are passionate about rescue because dogs, whether they're a foster or a new member of your family, they rescue us right back. Each week, we invite a member of the dog rescue community to talk about their passion for rescue dogs and how their life has never been the same. This is Rescue Dog Love, a rescue community podcast. I'm Yamini, and this is my first rescue, Bus.
Hello and welcome back, rescue dog lovers of the internet. Sorry in advance for the terrible audio quality. Some of you know I have just moved and finding my microphone cord is hard, so apologies for this, and it'll affect the recording today as well. So please don't give me a bad review because of it. Hope all of you in Toronto and other affected areas survived that massive thunder snowstorm on the weekend and that your dogs have enjoyed the remnants, aka the fluffy white stuff. I also just want to say thank you to everyone who supported my last Instagram post. I did really feel the love and I really appreciate everybody who put an effort to just read it and put a little heart. I really do appreciate it. All right, now to today's business. Today's episode is with Sharon from Human Canine Collaborative, and she has the account Holistic Dog Expert on Instagram. Sharon is a human dog bond facilitator and has a background in occupational therapy and has also been a dog trainer, so she's kind of bringing those worlds together. In this podcast, we discuss her relationship with her canine collaborator, Muggins, and then we also pretty much spend the podcast talking about how to build a better relationship with your dog and how to communicate with your dog. She shares her skills and advice with new ways to understand you and your dog, which can include things like that I've learned all about, like nervous system regulation and somatic consent. We also chat about the experience of neurodivergence and how being neurodivergent can affect your experiences as a dog parent. So if you guys enjoy the discussion and are interested in maybe pursuing some one-on-one coaching with her, there is a discount code at the end for any of her services. And in the meantime, feel free to look at the link in the podcast description for a free copy of her co-regulation workbook, which can be a good way to get started. Thanks, everyone. Hope you enjoy the episode and see you next time.
Hello, Sharon. Welcome to the Rescue Dog Love podcast.
Hi, Yamini. Thank you so much for having me here today.
Thank you. I'm very excited to chat and first of all, get to know your dog because that is a big part of my process of learning all about you. Before we get into Holistic Dog Expert and every bit of knowledge you have to share, why don't you tell me about your rescue dog?
Absolutely. I always find a lot of ease talking about dogs, so I'm glad that you're starting with this question. My rescue dog is Muggins. Muggins is 2 years old. I use they, them pronouns for Muggins, and Muggins is a mix of four different breeds. We did a DNA test and we found that Muggins is treeing walker coon hound, plot hound, German shepherd, and the very best American Staffordshire terrier.
Oh my gosh, a lot of little working dogs just all coming together.
Oh yeah, big old bag of energy.
And how long ago did you adopt them?
I adopted them with my partner in March of 2021. So we're coming up on our second gotcha day this year.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. I always say I'm a pretty new dog owner myself. My first dog, I guess it'll be about 3 years soon, but it gets easier every gotcha day. I don't know. Maybe that's just me being a bit biased, but you kind of get in the rhythm of things.
That's good to hear. Yeah, you definitely do get used to things and get into a rhythm the longer that you live together.
And I think the dogs too, they just settle in into the routine that's being set for them. I know that we've just hit our first gotcha day with Queenie last November, and she's a completely different dog. I mean, she's actually more sassy in a way, but I know that's because she's getting really comfortable.
I love that. Sassy dogs are my favorite.
Me too. Speaking of, why don't you tell me a bit about Muggins' personality?
Muggins is like no dog I've ever met, and I've met thousands of dogs. And one of the most interesting things about Muggins is they love to just sit and watch. And they've been like this ever since they were really little. I was able to connect with their first foster mom who had them and their siblings from 4 weeks old until almost 2 months old. And they would just sit in their yard and just watch and just like observe everything. And they still do that to this day. They love to like sit at our front door. There's like a glass door they can see through, or we have this big bay window that has like a credenza in front of it. And Muggins will actually like climb up on top of the credenza with just their like front legs and their rest their belly. And they'll just like watch outside. And I love that they also do this when they've asked to go outside and I'm like, okay, buddy, I'll take you. I just need you to wait 10 minutes. And then they're like, okay. And then go over and climb up on the credenza and they'll just watch outside until I'm ready.
That's wonderful. In my new place, I have a little perching area by a window for the first time. My last few places, it just wasn't a place that was available for dogs. And Queenie's learning how to perch. So she could take some inspiration from the Muggins energy. I love people watching too. So I totally understand it. So you mentioned that they came from like a litter. Do you have any details about how they were rescued and how they eventually made their way into your home?
I do have some. Yeah. They were originally born in Tennessee and they were relinquished to the shelter at 4 weeks old with two siblings. And then they were in a foster home in Tennessee for a little while, about a month and a half or so. And then they were shipped up to New York and they ended up at Tompkins County Animal Shelter in Ithaca, New York. I ended up finding them on Instagram. I was scrolling through and saw their adorable little face. And Muggins's siblings were both adopted pretty quickly. Two-month-old puppies don't last long at the shelter. Those two were adopted really quickly. And then Muggins was having trouble getting adopted. And I remember when I saw their picture, it was like maybe a week or two after it had been posted. And I was like, oh, that dog is so cute, but they're probably not there anymore. But I reached out to the shelter because the description they had written was something about like, this dog needs a job. He's really bright, or they're really bright. They're looking for a really experienced owner. And so I was like, oh, that's interesting. So I emailed them and Muggins was still available and they were having a really hard time getting them adopted because there was a problem with biting. Muggins actually has an official bite history from less than 3 months old. But I have worked with dogs professionally for a long time. And so the shelter was really excited that I was interested. And they did a really great job. Tompkins County Shelter is 3 hours from me on a clear weather day. So they were able to do a Zoom call with me and the head trainer so that I could talk to the trainer about what Muggins needed and get to see what Muggins and get to know a little bit about them. And that call was really great. And then my partner and I decided to drive out there and meet them. Of course, we fell in love right from the start. And the shelter was so supportive. They like provided us with all of these supplies. They even let us like sleep on it a night because I really wanted to be sure that we were making the right decision and that Muggins was also wanting to come home with us. So we slept on it for a night and then we went to the shelter and picked up Muggins. And then there was a snowstorm. And so we had to drive home in the snowstorm with this puppy that we just met.
Is kind of how it goes when you're anywhere that experiences snow. My last foster, Lavender, also just had to do a very long drive after that. And sometimes, you know, it's that first experience, it can really set things up. So hopefully it went well.
It did. And that's so interesting that you say how it could set things up because it definitely did set things up for us. The drive was long and we had to go slow and we didn't know Muggins. So we didn't know how to communicate with each other yet. But Muggins is so bright. And I was just like really observing them. We had a crate in the car and Muggins was in the crate and I was sitting next to them. And I could just tell when Muggins needed to go to the bathroom. They were very intentional. They would just like stop interacting with me and sit and look out the window very intently. So I was like, told my partner, Tom, hey, we got to stop. I think Muggins has to go to the bathroom. And sure enough, they did. And literally it took us 4 hours to get home. There was not one accident in the car.
I love that. Yeah. It's like you were working on potty training literally off the get-go and in a car. Uh-huh. That's very important. It's harder in a car than at home.
Yeah.
So that's really great. And you said they're very bright. So I'm sure they just were like, if you get my hint, we'll get along.
Absolutely. And their hints were like so obvious. Like every dog communicates a little bit differently, but I could just tell Muggins is very intentional and very obvious with what they're trying to say.
Very interesting. And we'll definitely tackle more about those instances as we get into your practice. So you've mentioned that you have been working with dogs a long time. So I'd kind of love to hear just your career trajectory with pets and kind of how it led to where you are today with your practice.
I began as a dog trainer about 16-ish years ago. I started as an apprentice. I didn't have any formal schooling in dog training, and that's still not something that is required to be a dog trainer. So I learned on the job, and then I ended up getting professional certifications later on. And the place where I worked, we were doing a lot of rescue rehabilitation, and I saw a lot of dogs who had anxiety and aggression. And then I also had a really neat opportunity to direct a program that trained people and their dogs for work in animal-assisted activities, which is visiting programs in hospitals and schools and things like that. So I was doing that work for a while. And I also, at the time, lived with two of my own dogs who were registered therapy dogs. And I fell in love with that part of my work. And so I had aspirations to go back to school. And I was originally thinking I would go back to school for psychology and do something in animal behavior. But I was in Los Angeles at the time. And somebody from USC reached out to me because she wanted to bring dogs to campus for stress management during finals week. And she was an OT and OT faculty. And she introduced me to occupational therapy, which is OT. And I got really curious about occupational therapy. I met some other faculty in the program, and I just fell in love with that profession because it's occupational therapy is a profession that supports people in doing activities that they need and want to do. The magical thing about OT is like we really want to know what is meaningful to the individual, and we want to remove barriers to be able to do that. And I thought, like, what an amazing opportunity to incorporate dogs into therapeutic interventions. Because dogs kind of are like the companion animal that exists to help us do things. So I ended up going back to school for occupational therapy, and I got a master's in occupational therapy, got licensed in California. And then I also did a doctoral program in occupational therapy because I really wanted mentorship. There's a really, really great professional mentorship in that program. And I wanted to focus my skills on community-based mental health. So I ended up doing my residency with an organization called Painted Brain. And Painted Brain provides really neat community-based and arts-based activity-focused programming for supporting adults labeled with serious mental illness in reintegrating into the community. And Painted Brain is run by social workers. So I had this really neat opportunity to understand mental health from the lens of social work and at a community-based level. And while I was there, I developed programming that was both group and individual programming that was focused on supporting adults who were labeled with serious mental illness or who had experienced trauma or substance use in learning how to regulate their nervous systems through the lens of sensory processing. And I, throughout my schooling and learning about sensory processing, I became aware of my own neurodivergence. And so being able to support other people in learning about this to support their mental health and activity engagement was just really so wonderful to be able to do, to learn about myself and give back to other people in that way. And so we ended up selling that program and individual service to a treatment facility that was like a residential treatment facility for people who had just been hospitalized or who had experienced a severe trauma. And while I was working with individuals there were often people who were going to go home and take care of their dog, or people who sometimes they had discharged to an outpatient level, so they were at home learning how to take care of their dog again, but still coming for therapy during the day. And I loved working with those clients, obviously, because I knew a lot about what it means to take care of a dog and how to do that. And so I started blending this coaching program, like on nervous system regulation, with resuming care of your dog and incorporating your dog into your daily routine. I just got really passionate about that. So I ended up leaving Painted Brain and starting my own business. And now I focus all of my OT skills on supporting people in engaging in meaningful activities with their dogs. And I coach them on nervous system regulation and co-regulation with their dog through the lens of sensory processing.
Wow, that is such an interesting journey because you, like you said, you're like, I want to work with dogs. And then you find all this interesting pieces about working with people, which I'm sure as a trainer, you did a lot of, because I always say a dog trainer is a human trainer pretty much.
Exactly.
But then, yes, like there's so many relevant skills in what you do. I mean, in general, I've spoken, you know, to just the therapy techniques I learned for my own regulation. And a lot of it is always like, wow, this does sound really familiar to a lot of the baseline things you do for your dog, especially obviously if you have a difficult dog who's anxious or reactive or in general just a bit overwhelmed with the world around them. It all kind of stems from, I think, a lot of similar places. There's a lot of cross-section, even though we're two different creatures with different, you know, ways of living. So it's interesting that you're now kind of like an expert in both fields.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Something in me knew that I needed to develop skills for supporting humans, but like partially because I wanted to do therapeutic work. And so I wanted to understand like, what are the barriers to engaging in meaningful activities for people with mental illness or trauma or other challenges? Those people live with dogs too, you know, and I'm sure those various walks of life and challenges that they experience can impact their ability to care for their dog. But you're right, like training dogs is training humans. It's very rare that a dog trainer would work only with a dog and never with a human.
I mean, the human needs to implement everything and do the work and learn what their dog needs, like more than a trainer can, because at the end of the day, it's the day-to-day. So let's get into maybe that relationship building that you've said is a big part of what you do. Like, what does your practice look like in terms of that philosophy that you learned through your career?
Well, my practice now is called Human Canine Collaborative. And my philosophy, I don't know that it's developed out of my career or if it's been something that was like always inside me. And then in the past couple of years, I've been on this authenticity journey. And so it's come out more in my work. But my approach is non-hierarchical. So I really a person who believes that all life has value and that human life is not worth more than other forms of life. And I put that into practice with my dog by approaching them in a way that I recognize and appreciate that they sometimes know things that I don't know, either about themselves or the environment or about me sometimes. And that they can communicate these things to me, that they have thoughts, ideas, needs, desires that are valid and that I need to be able to recognize and understand so that I can meet their needs.
Yeah, that's so interesting because dogs really do, you know, they just analyze the world in a different way than us. Each individual dog could be more sight-driven, but in general, they are more scent-driven. Their communication styles are different than us. And obviously, even as a dog trainer, you probably see all the time just people who don't really understand the way dogs communicate to each other and how that can lead to misunderstandings. Because, you know, we are taught that a tail wag is a happy thing when that's not necessarily the case. Or we think of like bites or snaps as like predatory or like purposeful harm when dog to dog, that's not necessarily what the context could be.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting, yeah, to think about it that way, because I think a lot of people I talk to, they do know like what their dog is communicating. But it's all this like talk and like recommendations or things that you read on the internet or things like that, that people are somehow valuing more than their own intuition. And that causes a breakdown in the communication between themselves and their dog.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. I mean, the internet is ripe with so many different opinions, different directions of training. And it's really confusing landscape if you are, especially if you're passionate and you really want to make a big change or you have, you know, a really important goal in mind for your dog. Those things can really get in the way of setting you up for failure, kind competitive with your expectations.
I was talking with a potential client the other day and they were just like, I'm so overwhelmed. I don't know, like, what time should I feed my dog? How much exercise do they need? When should I be doing training? And I'm like, wow, like, yeah, it's so overwhelming when you're trying to listen to other people and you're not listening to yourself, or you're not listening to your dog because your dog knows what they need.
What does this practice look like? Maybe in like a day-to-day fashion, like if you're working with a client and they're like, again, they experience that self-doubt of like, but how do I really know? Like, how would you coach them to kind of embrace maybe what like that relationship and that communication is?
There's a number of different ways that I would support them in building the skills to listen to both their intuition and to their dog. I'm really big on building awareness and using like introspective practices and reflection. And I love worksheets too. So sometimes we'll be in a session and there might be something I'll do to help them build awareness, like maybe a guided visualization or something, or it might be an observation of the self where I'll guide them through a body scan so that they can start to notice the sensations that are coming up in their body. Or I might educate them about the nervous system and about how it functions and what kind of ways the nervous system communicates with you. And then I might educate them on just like dog nervous systems and behavior and how like certain behaviors can help us understand if the dog's nervous system is in one state versus another. And then I will give them some homework. So I might give them a worksheet that has like certain prompts that they will reflect on and journal on, or an activity that they do for like practice listening with to their own intuition, or to practice observing their dog and then maybe journal on what they're noticing. And I give them a lot of guidelines that are like sensory based, like pay attention to what you hear, pay attention to what you smell, pay attention to what you see. And then also like lots of words for describing these things, like describing the sensations that come up in your body. Like, is it pressure or is it temperature or is it tingling or is it ticklish, or, you know, like just building their vocabulary so that they can start to describe and become more aware of what's going on.
I can see a lot of tie-in with what the whole journey of therapy can be. Obviously, if you have a therapist who is aligned with like the same value systems you are, it's always interesting to just take that and like apply it to your dog. So maybe we can go through maybe just some misconceptions that people have about what being a dog owner is, you know, or what dog behavior can look like. What are some common pieces that you've seen in your work with your clients?
Well, a common misconception, I think, is that dogs are not capable of the complexity of communication that they really are. Like, dogs can have back and forth conversations. They can understand a lot of words. So if you're really intentional about teaching words and being consistent, dogs can understand like so many more things than we think that they can. Another misconception is like people don't realize what they are capable of. You know, like we think of animal communication as something that's like for extra special people only. You know what I mean? And it's not something that we can tap into with our own dog. But if you practice, then you can develop these skills of like being still and really listening and noticing subtle differences or nuance, and learning to recognize like when your dog turns their head one way, it means something. And when they turn their head a different way, it means something else, you know, and you can really learn that and develop that skill.
That's very cool. So we already discussed maybe like the worksheets and all of those pieces. Like, how does working with you, like, how do you feel like the trajectory goes to that stage?
It really depends on the client. I feel like everybody comes in at a different place, and then our work goes to different, you know, different paths depending on what the person needs and what the dog needs. So for example, I had a client who came to me right after his dog had bitten him pretty badly, and the dog had been growling for months and it just got worse and worse. And so immediately the initial situation was a trauma, and this human needed a lot of care just to stabilize because they were so overwhelmed and and they were really scared. Their dog was really scared. So in that situation, it was just like, let's establish safety. Let's help you regulate your nervous system. Let's help you process what happened and understand what happened. Processing a lot of shame and guilt that was coming up. Then once everything was stable, it was, okay, how do we rebuild the relationship? So that one, we were like really starting from a bad place and having to rebuild and finding like ways for this human to connect with their dog in a way that felt safe. So one of the things I recommended right away was like, just sit down on the floor every day near your dog and do some deep breathing, and don't ask your dog to do anything. Just be there and show your dog that you are calm. And that became one of the most favorite routines that they have now together. Like the client sits on the floor and the dog crawls into his lap and they have this snuggle time. And it's just like so beautiful that they could get back to that place relatively quickly, actually. And then the trajectory went on to supporting the client in providing a daily routine for the dog that was less stimulating, and learning to understand how to respond when the dog is growling. So I had recommended, when your dog growls, say thank you and walk away. And previously, it was more confrontational because this person had heard, you know, like, you're not supposed to allow that. You're supposed to punish that. And so we just had to really change the paradigm on that and practice gratitude. And that was huge. So the growling then decreased tremendously. And then now the client actually has two dogs, and the second one is younger, and she's really excitable and a little bit reactive. So we're focusing more on her now, and we're teaching the client how to just really understand, like, how does stimulation impact the dogs, and how does that impact reactivity? How does the younger dog's reactivity impact the other dog and his aggression issue? And how do they like navigate situations like taking walks or somebody coming to the home, and like building the client's awareness that he has a lot of power to change things. A lot of people feel like, and this client in particular jokes about this a lot. He's always like, oh, it's my fault. And then he'll like tell the dog, oh, it's your fault. But he's like joking. But at the same time, a lot of people feel a lot of shame when they think about, oh, something I'm doing is contributing to my dog's behavior. And the fact is that it is. Something you're doing is contributing to your dog's behavior. I don't want you to acknowledge that because you're a bad person or because I want you to feel shame. I want you to acknowledge that because that means you can do something about that. You can't necessarily change who your dog is, but you can change yourself quite a bit.
Yes. And I think related to kind of this story you've been telling, there's a lot of emphasis from dog trainers as well. Like, you definitely emphasize, you know, the dominance theory idea of like, you know, your dog's getting away with X, Y, Z, therefore you have to stop it. But also I think a lot of people will be like, stop being anxious. It's making your dog anxious, or like, you are in disarray, so your dog is. And it's really hard, I think, probably for a lot of dog trainers as well, who are, you know, it's a hard thing to say to someone, but also like not helpful from a therapy perspective of just like, I can't just stop my anxiety. I can't just stop, you know, this. But I think kind of like you worded it, you know, I think as a dog owner, you have to prioritize yourself too, because at the end of the day, if you have this relationship with the situation of being around your dog, that's just like not giving you happiness. Like, how can you have happiness with your dog? And I think it's really hard when you have a reactive dog and you're nervous about going on walks. Like, you have to separately work on how it's making you feel, but also then work on why your dog is doing that. And those are like two different things that are both equally necessary, I think.
Yeah. I appreciate hearing you separate those things out, because it's, you definitely have to address how you feel, especially in response to your dog. And I know that's something I have struggled with a lot. And definitely when I'm struggling and I'm not well, Muggins is not well at all. And then my mind will play tricks on me, right? So I'm like seeing Muggins, you know, have this response response to my anxiety. And then I start going like, oh my gosh, I'm a bad dog owner. I'm failing. I'm doing everything wrong. And then it just gets worse. I just spiral into this like shame, like mess. And then I can't do anything to help Muggins.
Yeah.
But if I can, like, what I've tried to do is actually learn to recognize, like, when that critic part of me comes out, it's a sign that I need care. It's not a sign that I'm failing. It's a sign I need support. And the critic part of me is trying to help me. It's trying to go, like, here's something that you could do differently. And I just need to find a way to support myself and, like, take care of my feelings, take care of my body. So then the critic will calm down. And then that brilliant superstar part of me can come out and go like, okay, I know exactly what to do.
And I think sometimes too, it's like, yeah, learning, like, is this a day that I just need to take a full break? Maybe ask a friend or another family member to help me take my dog out just for a quick pee. Or maybe you just need to fake it till you make it. There's some days where that works great. Like, I remember too, like, if I'm pissed off at my dog, sometimes I just need to play with them. And I'm like, oh yeah, this is like why I love having a dog. Like, remind yourself of like just good little moments. And you gotta obviously, like you said, do that introspection work and see what you need at the moment, which can change. But if you take care of yourself first, I think your dogs will be able to support you because they want to do that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that you talked about like, take a break, ask someone else to walk the dog or ask for support in some way. It's so important to be able to do that. And it's hard to do because you have to be vulnerable to say, I can't do this. Can you do it for me? But I heard something that really helped me, which was asking for help is not giving up. It's refusing to give up.
Oh, I like that because I definitely am guilty of, I'm in the process of learning how to ask for help for sure. Especially, you know, outside my immediate structure, you know, asking like a friend to just come from far away and come hang out with you. Like, I think pieces like that are where that vulnerability really shows, and it's okay. People want to help you. I would love to also get into, so through your practice, what other pieces have you learned about how to communicate with your dog, which like all of my listeners can maybe take away and put into practice?
I have been learning about something called somatic consent. I learned from Mia Schachter, who runs the account at consent.wizardry, if anyone's curious. I learned about somatic consent as part of my own trauma recovery and mental health. And then it just made sense to incorporate it with Muggins. What people think about consent is they think about asking permission or giving choices, right? Especially when we're thinking about consent with dogs, we're thinking about giving choices and asking first. But those are only two small pieces of what somatic consent is. So the word somatic means of the body, and consent is a practice. It's like a lifestyle of how you listen to yourself to recognize whether you are a yes or a no for doing something. And your body always has some sort of sensation or feeling attached to whether you want to do something or you don't want to do something. And the same is true for dogs. They have body feelings that are related to whether they want to do something or don't want to do something. And so it's this practice of learning to listen to myself, learning to pay attention to how I am like asking my dog to do something. Like, am I asking them to do something for me or am I offering to do something for them? And then listening to them. So listening involves not just my ears, but listening with my whole body. So paying attention to my senses. What do I see? What do I smell? What do I hear? What do I hear has so many different levels. It's like, not just is my dog barking, but what does the bark sound like? Is it fast? Is it slow? Is the pitch high? Is it low? Is there a lot of breath in it? I'm paying attention to smells and subtle like changes in facial expression and body language. And then like, it's like a balancing of priorities, right? So balancing my needs with Muggins' needs. So for example, like if we're going for a walk and Muggins wants to go a certain direction, I have to recognize what Muggins is asking for. And then I have to think about, okay, do I have the capacity to go that way? Is that going to make our walk go a certain length of time? Do I have to get back for an appointment? Am I hungry? Do I have to go to the bathroom? How cold am I? Is Muggins going to be hungry soon? Do I have enough treats available. So it's like a weighing of all of these things, but really being present with it so that I can make the best decision for both of us.
How does that consent work in like daily practice? This is a new thing that Queenie has started doing. Queenie's been my angel dog. She's like very lazy. She just loves to sleep. She loves to be warm. And she's just been like a cuddle monster. Goes out when you go out. She's been very easy. Recently, her favorite thing to do is if I do a correction, either to her or my other dog, that it sounds a bit too harsh, she starts barking at me like incessantly, like 20 minutes, like just like over and over. I found that like the only things that like kind of work, and they don't work all the time, is like I'll try and engage her in play because I wonder if she has like a lot of energy these days. Again, she's pretty lazy, so maybe sometimes I wonder if she just like is just has this pent up burst of, you know, zoomies, but it's coming out in this way. I guess like how would I like look at that situation and maybe like do this work and think about how do I like engage her in an activity that she wants to do, and how do I, you know, correct her, tell her that, you know, it's late at night, please don't, I have neighbors. In a way that, you know, helps her, I guess, like we have that mutual like conversation.
I'm curious about the correction piece. Like what can you describe? Like, are you just like telling the dog, like, don't do that or stop that or something?
Yeah. If I go like, too meanly. And it's all about tone. I've even, you know, I have a new roommate and now I'm telling her like, so when you correct, you have to do it in a happy tone. Otherwise she'll bark at you. She'll listen to a correction, but if it's too mean sounding, and the thing is, you know, with my other dog, he knows what those sounds are and he listens to them. But sometimes if I do them to him, she's like, jumps. She literally crawl out of her bed and be like, I'm here to tell you to stop.
Yeah. So it sounds like Queenie is telling you something that she perceives as very important.
Yeah.
So my first recommendation is listen to her. I've been like exploring this really interesting idea, which is, I mean, a lot of times this will happen randomly where Muggins will bark or sigh at a certain moment. And then I stop and go like, ooh, what did I just say? Or what was I just doing? And it's usually like really important. Like, for example, I check in with a good friend of mine every day and we like talk about limiting beliefs and we like realize things about ourselves. And sometimes Muggins is sleeping on this bed behind me and they'll let out like a really good like sigh. And usually when they do that, either me or my friend has just realized something really important. So I'm wondering, what I would say is when Queenie is barking like that, check in with yourself. What's going on with you? Is there something that you need that isn't being met? That by taking care of your needs, could you pacify Queenie or help her to feel like, okay, I've communicated what I need to say?
Yeah, I'll have to be more introspective next time it happens. It's hard because I think, you know, kind of like every dog owner, when your dog has a reaction, you get so swept up in the stress of fixing it. And you're like, okay, I need her to stop right away. What can I do? Let me try this. Let me try that. And yeah, it does kind of stop that process of like maybe understanding what's going on with you or what's going on with her. So I'm gonna be more mindful next time that happens. Hopefully not tonight.
Yeah. I'd be curious to hear how it goes. And another thing that you could try is just acknowledging her. I think when dogs don't feel heard or seen, then they repeat their message and the intensity increases. So if you could say like, just like whatever feels really aligned, you know, like, Queenie, I hear you. I hear that you weren't comfortable with the way I was speaking. Thank you for telling me. See what that does, you know, see what that does to your own nervous system and see what that does to her.
That I'm going to try for sure. Because maybe that, I definitely think I get elevated when she gets in that state. So it probably does continue the cycle. Well, here's a concrete example, I think, that maybe if anybody else is dealing with attention barking, they can take away.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of us have.
Let's talk about we can talk about your personal journey if you feel comfortable, but I'd love to also just chat about neurodivergence and dog ownership. I think neurodivergence is such a piece of the spectrum of just different identities that is recently coming really to the forefront. I think a lot of people are learning where they could sit in that spectrum. I think it's always been, you know, by the medical system really touted as like different mental illnesses or different like diagnoses. First of all, what is neurodivergence and how does that differ from maybe the conception that most people have about different identities?
So I'm going to start by sharing what neurodiversity is, and then I'll define neurodivergence. So neurodiversity is a term that was coined by somebody named Judy Singer back in like a while ago, I think 2000 or earlier. And she coined the term to just speak to the way that every human with a nervous system has a unique way of perceiving and responding to the world. My nervous system doesn't work the way your nervous system does, and your nervous system doesn't work the way another person's does. We all have a unique way of operating and thinking and being in the world. It's sort of a more of a social justice term. It's not a medical term. The purpose of talking about neurodiversity was to support advocacy of autistic people who have brilliant ways of being in the world, but because of our social structure and the dominant social perspective of what is, quote, normal, unquote, people who are autistic need to feel like they are not broken or defective because they're not. Their brains just operate in a different way and the world is not created to accommodate them. Autistic people coined the term neurotypical to talk about people who are not autistic. And so then the term neurodivergence came about as a response to the term neurotypical. And so neurodivergence just means somebody whose brain operates in a way that is different from most other people. But everybody is unique. It's not like neurodivergent people are over here and neurotypical people are over here and there's like two separate buckets. Yeah. It's more like there's this beautiful mosaic. Most people fit within a certain range and the neurodivergent people are beyond that range.
Thank you for that definition. I love, by the way, just when you said a long time ago, and it was like the 2000s, and I was like, oh my God.
Yeah, I know. I was like, wait, that is like 23 years ago.
Yeah, it is a long time ago, but that's really interesting. And I think it is a term that is, you know, in the social justice movement and just in general, obviously the sphere of just like how just social justice is becoming through the internet, like more accessible to people who don't necessarily study it, which I think can be a good or a bad thing, obviously. But that's really interesting that it came, you know, from that perspective versus a medical system, which is focused on defining and then not necessarily, you know, quote unquote, healing or fixing. When it comes to neurodivergence, how did you kind of like through your work explore what was important to you, especially as a dog owner?
Neurodivergence comes into my work because I identify as neurodivergent. So neurodivergence is kind of an umbrella term that encompasses autism and ADHD, also epilepsy, but also mental illness diagnoses like anxiety and depression and bipolar and schizophrenia. And it can also encompass acquired neurological differences like traumatic brain injury or the way the nervous system changes after a traumatic experience. So my neurodivergence it's a number of things. I've always had challenges with anxiety, especially in social situations and growing up as a kid. And I believe I've always had sensory processing differences. Although I am self-diagnosed, I've never been diagnosed by a medical professional other than myself, because I discovered sensory processing and neurodivergence when I was in school for occupational therapy. And so the way OTs look at neurodivergence is we look at sensory processing and how that impacts behavior and engagement in everyday activities. And so we look at all of the different senses. So we have our five external senses, and then we also have senses for like movement and the position of our head And then we have interoception, which is being able to sense or feel everything that's happening inside of our bodies. And so for each of those senses, you have a certain neurological threshold, which could be hypersensitive at one end, where you're like picking up on all the information from the environment and it's can be really like overwhelming. And the other end is hyposensitive. So you're not picking up on very much information from the environment. And then there can be this like behavioral spectrum as well, where some people are more active, they're like actively avoiding stimulation, or they're actively seeking it out. Or there's a passive behavioral response where you're just sort of allowing the environment to provide what it provides, and you're not doing anything to change that. And so everybody has a unique pattern for how their nervous system processes sensory information. And even each of your senses can have a different threshold. So for example, I am hypersensitive in my senses of hearing and vision and touch. And then there's also this thing that the nervous system does called modulation, which is like a fine tuning of attention, like paying attention to certain stimuli versus others, and filtering. So sometimes we need to pay attention to one thing and ignore everything else, but some people can have difficulty with that. And then there's like this regulating of behavior in response to what's happening around you. So when I was working in community-based mental health, I learned a lot about this, how to assess it, and how to educate people about this, and then how it related to activity engagement. And then I helped people to build daily routines that were more supportive so that they could prevent sensory overload and emotional breakdown and be able to pay attention when they needed to and make decisions and prioritize, or sometimes like use sensory strategies so that they could navigate an environment or situation that's really challenging.
There's a lot there that I think a lot of people, like you said, if you're not understanding yourself, these things can feel so overwhelming, whichever direction you're going, or you could feel misunderstood because you think people should be behaving a certain way or reacting a certain way. And it can create a lot of confusing feelings. So I think just knowledge and understanding that all of these, you know, different experiences exist is just a great starting place to look introspectively and identify how you like operate in the world around you. And then, you know, again, how that impacts your relationship with your dog. Because I don't know, I feel like dogs, I have always said that most dogs I know just behave a lot like neurodivergent humans, especially rescues. I think because they've all undergone so many big changes and experiences, like being transported across the country, or, you know, even just that in itself, not even based on their rescue history. Hopefully that's not a bad comparison, but I just always, okay, good. I just am like, I'm not trying to do anything to bad.
We do have evidence too that shows like certain dogs can have difficulties with attention and hyperactivity. We know that dogs can have anxiety and depression and hallucinations and compulsive behavior. And dogs experience trauma and they demonstrate post-traumatic stress. So I believe that neurodivergence does occur in dogs, because diversity of nervous systems occurs in any species that has a nervous system.
Very cool. I mean, that's just like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's a concept maybe that we all just have to come to terms with, just to understand how we operate in our daily lives, and obviously then how our pets and other animals in the world do as well. I would love to talk about maybe, you know, some struggles that dog owners can have if they, you know, are anywhere on that spectrum and are struggling with their neurodivergence, maybe with either a new diagnosis or an old one. How can, you know, this spectrum make dog ownership feel really difficult and maybe even really isolating?
Dogs present a lot of sensory experience to us. You know, they bark really loud sometimes and it can startle us, especially if the dog is startled. They can pull on the leash, and that's a sensory experience where you like might not have control over your body, you know, depending on how big your dog is. If you're training your dog and using positive reinforcement strategies, then you're giving food to your dog and they're slobbery sometimes, or dogs have varying degrees of how well they can control the force of their bite. So that can provide a sensory experience. And then there's smells that dogs produce as well.
Many, you know? So especially so rescues fun. Or especially if you foster.
That just living with a dog can present a sensory overwhelming situation. And then if the dog is struggling with their mental health or their behavior, then that can create a lot of unpredictability in, like, how are they going to behave? Are they going to react? They are reacting unexpectedly and producing sounds that are overwhelming our senses or just triggering a fear response in us because we weren't expecting that, or that sound is so loud, it hurts me. You know, and so it can be really challenging. And one of the things that I noticed was most challenging for me with Muggins was walking, especially when we would come across another person or a person with their dog. Muggins would react. They would get excited and also nervous. So there would be a lot of pulling and jumping. They would kind of lock eyes on the other person and dog, and they needed to really look at them for a long time in order to gather information. But that meant they're not looking at me, and then they're pulling on me, and they are almost the same weight as me. So yeah. I was like, really feeling scared and panicking. And then I would go into a freeze response. So my mind would go blank. And there's this person like asking me if they can come say hi to my dog. And I'm like, I don't know. And I would just like run away. And it was just so like mortifying and humiliating. Plus felt really scary.
Yes, I can think a lot of people can relate to that. And I think just again, that cycle of shame that we go through when we have any social situations, I think that's why reactivity, it feels so like it really digs into that because it's happening in public spaces. Yeah. You're witnessing other dog owners, wondering if they're judging you, wondering if regular people are judging your dog, and lots of cycles of that can happen. I would love to also maybe talk about the other side, like how does maybe like your experience of neurodivergence help you be a better dog owner, or help you be like the best dog owner, like the most introspective dog owner ever?
Thank you for this question. I love it. One of my special sensory gifts is that I can see all the details. I just absorb all the details. So I'm really good at noticing subtle changes in Muggins. And I'm really good at understanding how the environment might impact their behavior. So I'm able to like very quickly analyze a situation and go like, oh, that's not going to work. This is going to be better. Or like, hey, let's dim the lights right now. Or you know what? We need to go downstairs away from the front window for a while. So I'm really grateful for that about myself, that I'm just able to see everything that needs to be seen.
Yeah. And I think with that introspective work you're talking about, you just get to learn more and more about what helps you feel balanced and, you know, stable and in your happy place. And then in turn, you can find that out about your dog. And I just think that's a wonderful thing. There's a lot of information out there for us to find. And like you said, if you're fine-tuned to it, then it's a really great advantage that you can have. Finally, what kind of tips would you give anyone who's, you know, struggling with anxiety, depression, bipolar, or any of those mental illnesses, or is neurodivergent in general? What tips do you have for them to help them with their daily struggles with their dogs?
Yeah. One of the things that I think it would be really great for all people to know is that you are the expert on yourself and your dog. So if you are having this feeling like a lot of people will tell me like, oh my gosh, I always say yes to that. And it doesn't go well. Like, oh, why did I let that person bring their dog over to me? So mad at myself. You know what I mean? So like you have the power in you to know what is best for you and your dog. And don't let anybody talk you out of that because you are the expert. No dog trainer knows more about you and your dog than you do.
That's very true. And I think too, like just recognizing patterns is a great skill. Like you said, I think it's great to maybe let's try and bring my dog to a patio and see how it goes. And if that's overwhelming for you or for your dog, and it could be like, sometimes I've just noticed recently, you know, I love bringing my dog everywhere, but I don't get to like really hang out with my friends and really have a good time taking care of my dog. Even though my dog is pretty good at a patio now, even though she sleeps, I'm like, well, my distraction is elsewhere. So sometimes it's just okay to, you know, do what's best if you see, if you notice a pattern going on with either you or your dog about what makes you happier, what makes you more calm.
Yeah. And definitely don't be afraid to take breaks. It's okay to not bring your dog, or like, it's okay to say like, we're not going today, or to like go out and do something for yourself that's just for you. It's not a bad thing that you need a break. You know, everybody needs a break. It would be weird if you didn't need that.
It's very true. Love our dogs, but I think being a human is multifaceted. And if you don't experience changes and differences, you don't appreciate what you have. And that's when you can become a little exhausted with the day-to-day management of being a dog owner.
Yeah, that's a great way to say it. In terms of neurodivergence, one of the things that I have brought from my work as an occupational therapist and like my own lived experience is something called sensory budgeting.
And I just love that name. Yeah.
So this is a concept that I developed because I recognize that I seem to have a certain capacity for sensory exposure. And then when I go beyond that capacity, it's like meltdown city. So once I was able to name that and start to be able to feel it and know like, okay, I'm approaching my capacity for sound, or oops, went over my capacity for sound. I am done with conversations for today, or like whatever it was. Then I had a lot more power and agency for being able to set boundaries and say like, no, I am not going to do that today because it's not within my capacity. Or to be able to say, you know what, I do want to do that. And these are the conditions or the supports that I'm going to need to be able to do it well. And so I taught this with two other people who also are neurodivergent, and people found it really helpful to be able to think of their sensory exposure as a budget and to recognize like certain experiences have a cost and other experiences have a gain. And so if we can just get familiar with what the cost is of certain experiences, then we can really get to know like what is good for me and what is not good for me. And I am starting to explore the same concept in regard to dogs. So if a dog is hypersensitive, or even if they're not, you know, I think that sensory exposure impacts them. And then if they have too much exposure, or they're overstimulated or overwhelmed, then they can have a meltdown. And that can look like more reactive behavior or aggression or anxiety. And so if we can learn our dog's sensory budget, then we can start to have a lot of agency with planning their day and deciding whether or not we're going to take them to that place or invite this person over or whatever it is.
Yeah, definitely. I think we focus a lot on that, at least at the rescue, when dogs are introduced to homes, you know, like you have a foster or you have your new dog, like make sure you don't, you know, yeah, you don't invite people over for this much time, let them get used to their space and all of that. But I think it's just really easy to start letting that stuff go, especially if your dog is relatively well behaved or will accept situations. Because I think, like you said, this is something that I know I do. I know a lot of people around me do. You almost don't realize how much you're over budgeting in terms of what you need until it's too late and you're like meltdown mode. And yeah. I think that's so important to just keep that in mind, no matter how your dog is behaving. You know, they need their time to rest. They need their time to enjoy enrichment. They need their walks, like just like all those things that we put in front of them. They need to, you know, experience them in a way that's beneficial and not detrimental. It's interesting because it's related to a lot of what we learned through training, you know, over socialization or getting their threshold when you're like training for reactivity. You start really small. and you increase as they're able to, you know, be able to stay calm and stay neutral. So I think it's really a good way to look at behavior, because like you've said, you know your dog and you know what excites them, you know what scares them. So it's good to maybe think about that when you're planning out their whole day or even their week. If they're having a big play date with a dog they like, maybe they need to rest the next day and recover and have a more low-key day.
Yeah, you're right. There are a lot of parallels that we think about with new rescues, and expanding on that to encompass the life of the dog could be really supportive for both the person and the animal.
No, that was a really good ad. Thank you. Sharon, you did share your digital workbook with me to share back with my listeners. So yeah, what is it? Why should people check it out?
Yeah, this is a digital workbook called Co-Regulation with Dogs. It's an introduction to the concept of co-regulation with your dog, which is the process of learning how to engage in activities with your dog that help both you and your dog shift your nervous system into a more calm or regulated state. And so this workbook will explain the whole concept to you and will help you to start building awareness of what's going on in your nervous system. And there are two exercises for you. One is a breathing exercise that you can just do on your own to help yourself decompress and relax. And there's a breathing exercise that you can do with your dog to teach your dog how to use breath to calm and relax their nervous system as well.
Ooh, I love that. Maybe I'll try that out tonight. It's getting, as you can tell, it's getting nice and dark. So could be some a good way to decompress for the evening. I will have the co-regulation digital workbook available in my show notes through the link you provided. So thank you for that. And feel free to check it out, everybody. You've also created a discount code for my listeners, which I really appreciate. So if anybody out there looks through Sharon's site, this is for booking with you, right?
Yep, you can use it for any service.
Right. So any service, you can use the code RESCUE when purchasing anything from Sharon's site, which I will share below, and you can get 15% off. Thank you for that. Where can people find you online?
You can go to my website. It's hc-collab.com. So HC like happy cat dash C like cat, O-L-L-A-B like biscuit.com. That's my website. You can also find me on Instagram at holistic dog expert. That's holistic, starting with the letter H, O-L-I-S like Sam, T like Tom, I-C like cat, dog expert. And that's the end of it. And you can also email me. My email address is Sharon@holisticdogexpert.com.
Great. Thanks for sharing all of this with us today. I think it's a really, really helpful episode that hopefully will help a lot of people just take a second, reflect, and just think about what they can do to continue building their relationship with their dogs, which is at the end of the day, I think just the goal we all have is just to have an amazing time with them.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for having me on. It was such a great conversation.
Thank you, Sharon. Goodbye.
Rescue Dog Love is a project by Yamini Cohen, inspired by her rescue dog boss, who you can find on Instagram with his doggy sibling Queenie at Queenie and Boss. To keep up with the Rescue Dog Love podcast, you can follow us at rescuedoglove.com or at Rescue Dog Love Pod on Instagram. See you next time.